Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. With the passing of Maurice Sendak this week, it's time to pause and remember the great contributions of this children's author and artist. We'll do that today with our book doctors, and one of the books we'll rave about today is the latest from Robert Caro, the biographer of Lyndon Johnson, who's out with Volume 4 of what is, to me at least, his just breathtaking review of the 36th president's life. We'll cover a whole bunch of other books today, too. The book doctors today are book editor and writer Steve Paul from the Kansas City Star. Stephen, welcome back.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me back.
Katie Stover is the Reader's Services Manager with the Kansas City Public Library. Katie, good to have you,
Happy to be here.
And Adrienne Russell's back. She's a freelance writer. Adrienne, good morning to you, too.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, Katie, the big passing this week, the big news this week with the death of Maurice Sendak, what do you think of him? When you do think of him, what comes to mind?
Well, everyone thinks of Where the Wild Things Are.
Yeah,
that's probably their first introduction to Maurice Sendak. And then there's a host of other books they probably think of as well. Pierre, the little boy who didn't care. They probably think of really Rosie, that brash little girl who always created these elaborate dramas, usually starring herself.
You're taking me back to when my kids were young.
You see, yeah. You remember all of these. And I'm sure many folks read one of the follow-ups to Where the Wild Things Are, In the Night Kitchen, that features Mickey and the milk and getting baked in the batter. And then the third one in that loosely connected trilogy, according to Sendak, is Outside Over There, which talks about Ida and her search for her baby sister who was snatched by goblins. And if you put all three of those books together, Where the Wild Things Are, In the Night Kitchen, and Outside Over There, number one, you'll be struck by the change in the artwork that Maurice Sendak used for all three. More hash marks in Where the Wild Things Are, more fine lines. Looser lines, thicker outlines for In the Night Kitchen, and then very dreamy, shaded pastels for Outside Over There. He seemed to be a master of many different forms of art for his children's book. I have to point out my favorite illustrated book by Maurice Sendak, one that he did not write, is Mr. Rabbit and the Lovely Present. And this was written by Charlotte Zolotow, and it was published in 1962, the year before Where the Wild Things was published. And this book has some of the most beautiful watercolor illustrations that Maurice Sendak has ever done. I know it's the classic. I know that people have read it. But I don't know if it's the book that comes to mind when people think about Maurice Sendak. But it's the one that comes to my mind. Beautiful illustrations as this little girl searches for a birthday present for her mother. And what she wants to give her mother, in typical child fashion, is red and blue and green colors. Things like that, things that would fall into a child's mind. And Mr. Rabbit helps her find fruit. But at the same time, throughout the story, Charlotte Zolotow is teaching children about objects that are these different colors. Red fire engines, yellow canaries, green grass, green emeralds, and blue stars.
You know, Adrienne, in the ranks of the great children's book authors over time, where does he rank? I mean, is he right in the top three, top five for sure, or what do you think?
Well, for me, he is. I actually had three copies of Where the Wild Things Are. My brothers and sisters and I literally read it to death. It fell apart several times. Eventually, my mother just stopped buying it. But I'd say he has to be, at least in my top five.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good indication of the depth that children authors can go to. I think people tend to discredit people that write for children and for young people. But, I mean, he's just so skilled. I have a hard time finding anyone that beats him.
Well, what is it about Where the Wild Things Are that absolutely captured people to the extent that it did? Katie, what do you think?
Well, it was one of the first children's book that opens up with a kid getting sent to his room for very bad behavior.
Yeah.
And he's the hero of his own little fantasy, his dream. He's angry at his parents. He's continuing to yell at his parents when he's being sent to his room without supper.
Meaning he captured the real feelings of real children.
Yeah. He did. And that's what happens in these other books as well. Mickey is yelling in bed, quiet down there, to the bakers who are making all this noise. And then he loses his clothes as he falls into the night kitchen. And Ida just runs off without telling her mother to rescue her sister. But Maurice Sendak explored the psychology of what was going on in a child's mind and played up these fantasies, these dream worlds, and gave them a respectability, a credence that this is believable, this is allowable in child's minds.
And it's safe to say that he sold in the millions of books?
Oh, it's so safe, Steve. Here's what I have for you. As of 2009, 19 million copies of Where the Wild Things Are had been sold.
Just that one book?
Just that one book, 10 million of those in the United States. So I did a little math, and I would say that as of this year, 26 million copies of Where the Wild Things Are, and you know that that number has probably shot up since Morris Sundyke's death earlier this week.
Well, a major passing for sure. When you look at the book world these days, there is one title that's getting a whole lot of buzz, and that book is 50 Shades of Grey. Adrian, what is it?
It actually is erotic fiction created by the author E.L. James. It started off as fan fiction for the Twilight series. And so we're to put in the place of Edward and Bella the characters of Christian Grey and Anastasia. And basically, they have a submissive and dominant relationship. And I'm not quite sure how much I can get into detail on the radio.
We get your drift here,
right,
I think.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that people are waking up to is that it's this huge thing in the media about, oh, women are reading erotica and it's this big deal. And I don't think that's ever not been the case.
No.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah.
They've been reading it.
So I'm not sure why it's such a big deal. They've actually dubbed it like mommy porn. It's a very strange thing.
What's your best guess? Why has this thing taken off this way? What do we know about that?
Well, my guess, I haven't been able to get my hands on a copy. All of the copies at the Kansas City Public Library are checked out, and that includes the print, the digital, and the audio. Mm. But my guess is that since this started from Twilight, and that's not the most well-written piece of literature on the planet, I'm sure Steve would agree, but it's got a very compelling plot, and I have a feeling that that's the same thing with 50 Shades of Grey. It's the kind of story that mm-hmm. people want to read, and I'm sure all the buzz and word of mouth is helping the sales and the interest go along.
And social media, of course, has accelerated word of mouth in a big way, and that's certainly where some of this mania comes from. But of course, then there's always the press, you know, we latch on to these
and off we
things
go. Yeah.
And we fuel the hype and all that. And, yeah, it's one of these blips of culture that we suffer through occasionally. I'll say absolutely nothing else about it.
There have actually been protests about this down in Florida.
Yes, there's a library down in Florida, and there's one in Georgia and one in Wisconsin, that are not collecting copies of 50 Shades of Grey. And they've got good reasons for that. It's being promoted as erotica, and it's written into those libraries' collection development policies that they do not collect erotica. Hmm. And one library came right out and said, it's getting we're not purchasing it because it doesn't meet our selection criteria because it hasn't received what they would consider good reviews.
You know, I will
breaking
talk
your
about,
promise.
Yes,
here.
I'm breaking my promise. Yeah. One, you know, along the lines of there is nothing new here. Readers of Anne Rice, I have not read Anne Rice for a million years, but everybody knows Anne Rice under at least one pseudonym, maybe others, wrote a whole series of erotica, some involving vampires and other things. And I can't imagine that this book is anywhere near the mediocre quality of the Anne Rice books.
Very likely. I haven't read either. I know that KCPL owns the A.N. Roquelaure series that you're referring to, that Sleeping Beauty series.
The Kansas City Public Library.
Yes,
and
we
again,
do.
It does carry this title, 50 Shades of Grey.
We carry 50 Shades of Grey because we also have in our collection development policy that we will purchase on demand. And there's been a sizable enough demand. In one library here, apparently at Pinellas County Library in Florida, there are only 30 copies available of 50 Shades of Grey, but they've got 650 people on the waiting list.
Oh, my goodness. Well, if by any chance our listeners have taken a look at 50 Shades of Grey and want to tell us about it, 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. If you have the courage to admit you've read that book, you can tell us how good it is or how not good it is. 816-235-2888. Okay, let's go to our list this week. Katie Stover, start us off here with the title Treasure Island by Sarah Levine.
Oh, this is a funny book. I listened to it, and it's in audio format, Treasure Island by Sarah Levine. It's about a 25-year-old woman. Our heroine doesn't have a name, and she's very busy avoiding reality by getting biblio-obsessed with Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. And she's decided to live by these core values: boldness, resolution, independence, and horn blowing. And about halfway through, I realized that by horn blowing, she means bragging, not blowing a horn. And she's a narcissist. She's deluded. She's lazy. And there's still a smidgen of likability about this woman. And it's funny. It's caustic wit. You really will vacillate between, do you like this woman, and the selfish things she is doing to her family, to her boyfriend, to her friends. She steals $1,000 from her boss to buy a parrot because she thinks that's an act of independence and she's going to help her boss's business. Well, her boss doesn't see things that way. And yet our heroine doesn't understand the problem either. She exhibits resolution by refusing to leave her boyfriend's apartment after he throws her out for turning into a money junkie and running up his credit cards. And then when she moves home, she decimates her sister's romance by stalking her sister on a date. It's these ludicrous situations, and I can't imagine one reader who isn't going to feel a little elevated and better about their own life after reading about how this woman is wrecking hers.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the tone she takes. It's the tone that readers will appreciate that Sarah Levine employs in Treasure Island. The tone of the narrator and the book, that this utterly selfish 25-year-old is out there telling a story in almost an inspirational memoir fashion.
Hmm. That's Treasure Island by Sarah Levine,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Treasure Island with all the exclamation points.
Okay. We were talking a little bit before about 50 Shades of Grey. And Adrienne, you described it as what for housewives, for moms?
They call it mommy porn.
Mommy porn. Well, it figures that the only caller we have so far on this book is from Dave from Shawnee. Dave, welcome to the show. And what did you think of 50 Shades of Grey?
Well, I'm with your guest there. I don't understand the big deal. It's basically just a romance novel, it seems to me.
Mm.
I peeked over my wife's shoulder when she's reading it on the Nook. Because, you know, it's a big deal. All her girlfriends are raving on and on about this thing. Mm. I don't get it. Other than perhaps it's a little more explicit in S&M bondage kind of stuff. But That kind of ties into the vampire thing, too, I think, doesn't it? I mean, you get right to it. Anyway, that's my spin on it. It's no big deal.
Well, Dave,
spend your money on some other book.
Yeah, thank you for
I've
the call,
I've got a recommendation for you, Dave.
Yeah, what's that?
Coming right up.
Okay, well, coming right up here. Well, if someone does get what 50 Shades of Grey is all about and wants to defend it, 816-235-2888, our email address, up to date. At kcur.org. Steve, Paul, what do you have there?
Well, I'll talk about this book just to change the tenor of the conversation and get macho and male and kind of a little testosterone going in the room. This is a wonderful new novel. It's a first novel called Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk by a writer named Ben Fountain. Ben Fountain published a few years ago a very fine collection of short stories called Brief Encounters with Che Guevara. There was a combination of really acid humor and beautifully written stories, well-crafted stories. This is his first novel. It's just come out this week or last week. And it's about it's a war novel, essentially, but with a little bit of a spin. It's about a company a squad of soldiers who was brought back. They're on a break from Iraq, from the war, and they're being put around the country in kind of a hero's tour, traveling the country. And the action of the novel takes place pretty much in one day at Dallas Cowboys football game, and they're the halftime entertainment. And the setup, Billy Lynn and his six or eight comrades are kind of being presented to Dallas society and held up for this sort of heroic action that they were involved in one day, which, of course, and Billy reflects at one time, he doesn't understand why he's being honored for the worst day of his life. You know, a buddy is killed, but what makes this novel is really the voice, the male humor, the really acid kind of language that through which we learn about Billy and his his surroundings and the people he encounters. There's Fountain does a beautiful job kind of listening to how people talk and really creates a kind of comic portrait, skewering Texas pomposity, American hypocrisy, even male fantasy. Of course, there's an encounter with Dallas cheerleaders. They of course become involved in Billy's story, and in a way, it's a sad and it's a funny book at the same time, and really biting kind of biting take on American involvement in Iraq. Especially, and you kind of begin to wonder. I began to wonder whether Billy Lynn isn't some kind of echo of Billy Pilgrim, who was Kurt Vonnegut's character in Slaughterhouse Five. And I will mention the Carl Milantes, who gives a blurb to this book, calls it the Catch-22 of the Iraq War. And I think there is something to be said for that. It's really a fine book. It's called Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk by Ben Fountain.
Okay.
Who happens to be a lawyer turned writer down in Dallas.
Well, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCY. We're talking with our book doctors about some of the latest and best reads. Adrienne Russell, you're up next. What do you have there?
I have Unholy Night by Seth Graham Smith. He is previously brought us Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, and Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. So these historical revisionist mashups, usually involving a lot of gore and death. In this story, Graham Smith re-envisions the three wise men from the Bible. So instead of the kings who come to meet Jesus and Mary and Joseph in the manger, they're actually three bandits who have escaped from King Herod's dungeon. They've murdered the wise men. They've taken their clothes, and now they're looking for some place to hole out. They encounter, the three that we know, Mary, Joseph, and the baby. And basically there's an encounter with Joseph and a pitchfork that's very entertaining. And they basically say, we'll help you get out of here because we have to get out of here too, but you're going to have to put that down.
Mm-hmm.
And so they all go to Egypt and they're being chased by Herod's army led by a very young Pontius Pilate and an envoy from Caesar Augustus. So I really do like these mashups. I really have admiration for the historical research that he does do. And it is a very familiar story for those who went to church and you think you know the story every angle, every way. And he's managed to present it in a very human way and kind of making those characters less iconic figures and just more human beings, which, you would hope that they would be.
And what's the title of that book again, Adrian?
It is Unholy Night by Seth Graham Smith.
Okay. Great recommendation there. Again, if you're just joining us, we're talking with our book doctors. And if you have a recommendation for a good book you've read lately, 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. And we're still looking for someone out there to defend 50 Shades of Grey. If you have the guts, give us a call, 816-235-2888. Katie Stover, Sacre Bleu.
Oh, this book is a lot of fun. I'm going back and forth listening to Sacre Bleu by Christopher Moore and reading it because the print version has copies of the paintings that he's writing about. Sacre Bleu is sort of an absurdist look at the Impressionist movement wherein Christopher Moore is pondering, where did all those Impressionist painters get that beautiful blue, that ultramarine, the sacred blue that was used to paint the cloak of the Virgin Mary? And he's created a little figure called the Color Man, this unusual, mysterious figure, who is enticing these painters into using this color. And he's in the company of a woman who is a muse. I'm only about halfway through this because I'm loving every word. I'm loving what Christopher Moore is doing. It's funny. It's witty. It's a really compelling story. And I like this time period. I like reading about artists, and they're all hysterical. But the person driving this plot is Lucien Lessard, a baker's son turned painter. And he's not going to become one of the famous painters we're familiar with. He's the fictional character. But he and his friend Henri Toulouse-Lautrec are looking for the so-called murderer of their friend Vincent van Gogh. But what's wonderful about this book in audio is the narrator, whose name escapes me, is doing a marvelous job capturing the French accents, discerning between the men and the women. He does a wonderful James Whistler with this flat American accent and this testosterone-filled voice. And he's doing a wonderful job with all of the women and the description as well. Listeners to this book will be able to keep all the characters straight, and there's quite a few. If you're listening, though, you're going to miss the paintings that are included in the book, that Christopher Moore included, some with some unusual captions, funny captions that he's just pulled from his text. So I'm going back and forth as I listen and then flipping through the pages to look at the pictures because they're illustrating a particular scene. I'm struck by a painting of Whistler at a gallery opening surrounded by other painters. Monet is in the painting, Manet. I'm drawing a blank on the name of the painting. Bastille is also in the painting. But underneath it is the caption, "Hey, Whistler, how's your mother?" And that's not the caption of the painting. But that's what somebody greets James Whistler with. And he says, "Oh, she's gray and despairing. She's a study in grays and boring." And
not 50 Shades of Grey.
No, she's not. Whistler's mom isn't 50 Shades. She's you know, one solid gray color, and she is highly disapproving in that American way of her son.
And that's Sacre Bleu by Christopher Moore.
Sacre Bleu by Christopher Moore, a comedy d'art.
Well, I was going to recommend a book, The Art of Fielding by Chad Harbach, if I'm saying that right. And if Mark Luce was on our panel today, he'd be laughing because he was really put off by this book and said didn't really know where it was going. Well, I can sort of relate to that because I'm three quarters of the way through it, and I don't know where it's going to, but I keep reading it. It's a pretty good read about a college baseball team from a school in northern Wisconsin and what happens with these folks, including this incredibly gifted shortstop who makes a rare error by throwing the baseball into his own dugout and beating his own roommate and seriously injuring him. And the story sort of lifts on that moment, and you find out about the lives of the college president and the roommate and the shortstop and the shortstop's best friend. And I keep wondering where this book is going to. It's very well written, but you do wonder where it's going. And if Mark Luce was sitting here right now, he'd be saying, "Told you so, told you so." Okay, lots of phone calls here for folks who want to recommend some good books. And we do have a taker on our offer to defend 50 Shades of Grey from Glenda from Overland Park. Glenda, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead. You've got the air, Glenda.
Well, I have to tell you first why I read it, because I guess I have to defend myself a little bit here. I'm going to a 50th college reunion in Wisconsin in July, or June, I should say, and we always read a book every year, and when this group of women get together, and, oh, we've done The Help, and we've done, you know. So this year, 50 Shades of Grey, I knew nothing about it, but I ordered it. And I started reading it, and I couldn't believe what I was reading. Oh, my gosh. You know, I said to my husband, I'm 72. You could probably figure that out by 50th reunion. And we were going on a trip, and I'm reading. He drives, I read. And I said, oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Well, I finally got past about the first quarter of it. And then I had to stop, though. Every once in a while, I had to stop. I just couldn't handle it for too
long.
And
get a breath, you mean? Or
yeah,
fan
or
yourself?
Just stop and go away from it. And then I'd come back to it, and I thought, well, I have to do this. We're going to talk about it. I have to do it. Well, you know what? I got sucked into it. It's a really good story. It's so good
That's what people say.
Well, she leaves you hanging at the end on purpose because there are two more, I guess.
Two more coming.
Now I don't know if I can take this or if I just have to go ask somebody else what happened.
Well, Adrienne Russell is shaking her head vigorously here. She can relate, I think, to what you're saying, Glenda.
It's like nothing. I'm going to give it to my daughter-in-law now. I told her I wasn't going to, but after listening this morning, I'm going to give it to her. She's, 30 years younger than me.
Well, Glenda, you're saying it's like nothing you've read before. What's different about it?
Oh, I mean, it's just the graphic depiction of the sex is just, I guess I'm led a sheltered life here. I'm not too old to learn. I think this is exactly why Judy has chosen this for us, so that we'll know we're not dead yet.
Yeah.
That's a good discussion I want to be
a part
of.
Yeah, I
want to
be there.
I want to hear that.
You know, there's something interesting about that because in American literature and all sorts of literature, I mean, the depiction of sex is always kind of troubling. And John Updike was clunky when he got around to sex. And you can point to any number of kind of mainstream writers or literary writers who some sort of had problems dealing with sex because we never really knew how to, how far to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think erotica has pushed, into the mainstream in a way that we really expected.
And why go there? Is it serving the story or the characters in any mm-hmm. portion? Because I have to admit, I'm one of those romance readers that skips the sex. I want to get to the story. I want to get back to the plot, get back to the dialogue. And I'll skip it in the literary writers, too. I'm like, yeah, I don't know why this is here. Get back to what you're doing.
Oh, it has to be there.
Yeah, you can't skip that. That's the best part.
But for erotica,
it
it's
has
the point.
To be there because you can't understand the story mm-hmm. without it. You have mm-hmm. to know what's going through what's her name? No, I can't remember.
Anastasia,
Anna. You have to go through what she's experiencing in order to understand, where she's at and how it ends.
All right.
I think you do.
Glenda, I'm sure glad you called, and I hope you enjoy your book club with your old buddies. Yeah. Tape
okay.
it for us. We'll air it on the show sometime.
All right.
Bye-bye, Glenda.
Bye. Bye.
Allison from Prairie Village recommends An Object of Beauty by Steve Martin. Yes, that Steve Martin says it's a great morality tale and can be thought of as his great American novel. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We'll come back and continue with some more from the Book Doctors. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our talk about the big issues facing the Kansas legislature or our conversation about your mediocre royals, you'll find them as well as our visit with a National Geographic Explorer at kcur.org. Tomorrow, reviews of the latest art, independent, foreign, and documentary films showing on area screens. Well, this hour, we're visiting with our book doctors, book editor and writer Steve Paul, Katie Stover, the Reader Services Manager with the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, and Adrian Russell, a freelance writer. Your recommendations welcome for good new reads, 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Steve Paul. What do you have next there?
What's next? Well, I'll talk about a book that's gotten a lot of attention in the last week or so since it came out.
And it should.
You and I well know. This is The Years of Lyndon Johnson, Volume 4, called The Passage of Power by Robert A. Caro, who has been writing a massive monumental biography of Lyndon B. Johnson since the mid-1970s. Book 4 is the first. It's been 10 years, I think, since we've seen a volume. This book picks up in the late 1950s. Johnson is thinking about running for president. He's the Senate Majority Leader.
And what a fascinating scene this is. This is a guy who can make decisions with a snap of a finger, and he can't decide whether to run for the presidency or not. He's always wanted to do it, and he can't pull the trigger.
Yeah, he has this fear of failure, essentially, is what it is. And Caro goes deep into his psychology to talk about why. The fulcrum of the book, however, is the JFK presidency. Johnson becomes vice president. He hates it. He is shunted aside in a big way. He has lost the power that he had in the Senate. And then, of course, that fateful day in November 1963 when JFK is assassinated. Johnson takes over, ascends to power, and the portrait of Johnson in that role in those first hours and days and weeks of his new administration are just fascinating. How he completely changed his image, how he completely kind of changed what was going on in Washington and really helped the nation in the first few days. I mean, he gave a wonderful speech that nobody expected from him that helped the nation grieve and move on. And so, anyway, Caro's portrait is long and fascinating. You've got about 600 pages of narrative to get through. I found it to be a page-turner in a lot of ways. You know, he has a great narrative style. He really has a sense of the meaning of history. You come away with this. We're in the middle of a presidential campaign, of course, right now, and you come away with this, you know, trying to size people up and, you know, how do our politicians today, how do our politics today compare to what was going on in great detail in these years, and it's real fascinating.
Yeah, I will second comparison. Everything Steve has said. I have gushed about this in my column, and just a note: you do not have to have read the first three volumes
to launch into this one.
Carol does a great job of sort of bringing you up to speed and reminding you of things that have passed that you need to be aware of. But it's just an incredible book, and you're right; you keep turning the pages even though it's as long as it is. And that's Robert Carroll's fourth volume on LBJ, The Passage of Power. Some phone calls here. Leslie from Leawood. Leslie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. It's great. It's a great book. I agree. And I have another nonfiction. It's called Nothing Daunted. It's by Dorothy Wickenden, who's currently the editor at The New Yorker, I believe. And it's about her grandmother and a classmate of her grandmother's who set off from Smith College in the early 20th century, 1909. They graduated. They leave in 1912 to set out to teach in Colorado, way past the end of the railroad line, so to speak, and in a small community, and the adventures that they have while they're out there. And it is another time, and yet very recognizable time in terms of human storytelling and realities. It's a great read, and I believe we're lucky enough with Rainy Day that she'll be here in town this month. I'm not sure when, but maybe if you go online, you'll find it on Rainy Day's book page.
So. Well, what a wonderful recommendation, Leslie. Thanks very much. We'll have to think about getting her on the show. Appreciate it very much. Let's go to Megan from Overland Park. Megan, good morning. You there, Megan?
There.
Yeah, go ahead.
It sounds like you're trying to get a little more serious, but I wanted to tell about a book that I read that I didn't know was going to be as steamy as it was, and it was called A Reliable Wife by Robert Gulrich. And it was a little mommy porn. I've never read the Twilight series or 50 Shades of Grey, but geez, after Glenda's recommendation, maybe I will pick up 50 Shades of Grey. But this book was just recommended like on Facebook. But it's a story set like in the early 1900s. And it's like a mail order bride from this crazy guy in Wisconsin. And it turned out to be a very steamy story. And so it got a lot of us moms talking about how mommy porn isn't all that bad.
Hey, when you say it was recommended on Facebook, do you mean it was recommended by somebody you know, or there was an ad for it, or what do you mean by that?
You know, it's one of those things where somebody said, hey, does somebody know of a good book? Mm-hmm. And then there was maybe 20 people who had talked about books that they liked, and it was one of them, and I went in and thought that one sounded good.
Gotcha. Okay. Interesting.
Megan, thank you very much. We'll have to devote a whole show to mommy porn, it sounds like. Very hot topic here on Up to Date Today. Adrian Russell, you're up next. What do you have?
I have The Year of the Gadfly by Jennifer Miller. She's a journalist, and this is the story of a teenage girl named Iris DuPont, who goes to an exclusive prep school called Mariana Academy, where she's a complete outcast. She's obsessed with journalism and these things. This is a new word to me, called extremophiles, which are microorganisms that only live in inhospitable conditions. She imagines that her best friend is the ghost of Edward R. Murrow, and he advises her in her literary career. The course of the novel is she's discovered that at her school, which has a very strict honor code, there is a secret society. And it is called Prism's Party. And they have their own underground newspaper called The Devil's Advocate. And through their paper, they're exposing students and teachers who are violating the honor code. So she decides that she's going to infiltrate this secret society and figure out where their secrets come from and hopefully get to write for that paper. So as she does that, she kind of discovers that there's a delicate balance between her loyalty and telling the truth. And, you know, when she does discover some of these secrets, does she you know, honor her journalistic integrity and spill them, or does she keep them to herself? So I thought it was a really nice story. Even though the protagonist is a teen, I'm not sure it's necessarily classified as a young adult novel, but I think if you were reluctant about reading books about young people, this is a nice bridge. It's been described as kind of a literary mystery with this teenager at the center of the story. So if you are reluctant at all, check out The Year of the Gadfly by Jennifer Miller.
Okay, good recommendation. Marlene from Overland Park. Hi, Marlene.
Hi. I would like to recommend Unbroken. I know Candace Millard was on your show a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. It is one of the most fascinating books I have ever read. It's a tremendous eye-opener.
I think Candace Millard wrote the book on Garfield, but not Unbroken by Laura Hill.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, Unbroken.
Yes.
Excuse me.
Laura Hillenbrand.
That is another fashion. I forgot her name. By Laura Hildebrandt, sorry.
Right.
It is one of the most fascinating books that tells about courage, spirit, and determination and the will to live.
Yeah, I read it too, Marlene. I recommend it as well. Great read. Thanks very much.
But we'll also recommend Candace Millard's book, too, which was one of
the James Garfield books. Loved Destiny of the Republic. Yeah. Loved that.
Let's go quickly on one more round here. Katie Stover, what do you have?
Another post-9/11 novel, From the Memoirs of a Non-Enemy Combatant by Alex Gilvary. And it's subtitled, you know, A Fashion Terrorist Goes to Gitmo. But very quickly, a Filipino immigrant who wants to study fashion design in New York City is struggling to get his line open. He gets funded by a neighbor who lives in this rundown apartment building with him. And the neighbor is a Pakistani-Canadian who does have dealings in – does supply explosive fertilizer to Somalian terrorists. On the eve of a big order for his fashion line, Boy Hernandez is picked up by Homeland Security and sent to Guantanamo. And his memoir is told from his tiny cell in Guantanamo. He's talking about his rise, his home life in the Philippines, his rise to fame in New York, and now his experiences in the Guantanamo prison. It's fascinating. It's funny. It's breezy. It's very thought-provoking when you think about why some of these folks have been picked up for.
And that title again is
From the Memoirs of a Non-Enemy Combatant.
Stephen.
Yeah, I'll do a quick take on a brand new book that's much shorter than the LBJ bio. This is the new novel by Toni Morrison, our Nobel laureate. It's called Home. I'd probably call it a novella. It's about 145 pages or so. I went into it with some trepidation because some of the recent novels by Toni Morrison I felt were a little troubled and with cliche and kind of they really didn't pull me in. This one I feel as though it's going to be much different and much better. It's about a Korean War soldier who recalls a childhood witnessing a brutal event in Lotus, Georgia, the small town where there was no future, just long stretches of killing time. After the war, he's called back home. He kind of journeys from the West Coast back to small town Georgia, and it's an American tale and almost like a little allegory. It's quite nicely written, I'd say, and you know, Toni Morrison comes through once again.
Home by Toni Morrison. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Adrian.
I have Con Art, Why You Ought to Sell Your Damien Hirst While You Can, by Julian Spalding. He is a British curator and museum consultant. He's been the director of a few galleries there. And he basically believes that conceptual art is a scam. He has dubbed it Con Art. And he likens the overinflated art market to the subprime mortgage crisis. He says it's a bubble, it's about to burst. And he specifically mentions Damien Hirst, who began in the 80s as a conceptual artist and now has become something of kind of like a mythic rock figure in art. And he's a multimillionaire. He's collected all over the world and routinely does things like suspend sharks in formaldehyde He encrusted a skull in diamonds, and he has a large staff that makes the art for him. And so Spalding takes issue to that. He says that he has become more important than the art. He says that basically modern art died somewhere around 1937 and has yet to be resuscitated. So I thought that was an interesting take on it. I'm not sure I completely agree with all of his assessments. As an artist myself, I think if you can manage to get paid for your art, then I'm all for it. But he did raise some troubling issues just about the value of art and what makes art art and how do we assess the value, and kind of takes museums and galleries to task for kind of overinflating the market.
And that title again is?
Con Art, Why You Ought to Sell Your Damien Hirst While You Can by Julian Spalding.
Well, I will recommend the book Up in the Old Hotel, a collection of New Yorker stories by Joseph Mitchell. And that was recommended on the show a year or two ago by Gina Kaufman. Just incredible writing, snapshots of people and places in New York, including McSorley's Tavern. Just a marvelous tale. You can see and feel and smell this very unusual old tavern. And I have really enjoyed getting into that book. A couple of emails here. Nicole emails this: I cannot defend 50 Shades of Grey. I'm having so many problems with it on many levels. It makes sense now that your guests say it's a Twilight spinoff. No matter how Anna fights with her subconscious, she's still a prostitute. I have no problem with the subject matter. It's the way it's written. I suppose it's helping moms I know reignite the flame. I don't relate. The guy is a stalker and a control freak. That's from Nicole. And Dan in Kansas City writes this: I haven't read 50 Shades of Grey, but I'm very glad that my wife is reading it. Enough said. That's a good way to end this chapter of the book, doctors. I want to thank Steve Paul from The Star,
thanks,
Katie
man.
Stover from the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, and Adrian Russell. Thank you all for some very good recommendations today.
Thank you.
Pleasure
Had
to
fun.
Be here.
Had fun.